Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Measuring the economy is kind of like weighing yourself every day. You can't pay attention to all the tiny little changes or you'll go crazy, right? But sometimes you just need to know. So the American labor market week by week on the program today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Thursday, the 15th of December. Glad to have you with us. There is, and this is kind of an understatement, I know, a whole lot of data about the American economy. Some we pay attention to, some we don't. We usually put the weekly unemployment report, the number of Americans who made their first claims for unemployment benefits, in the don't pile, because that number comes out weekly, and measuring the American economy on a weekly basis is tricky. But we break with that tradition today. From Washington Marketplace's David Gura explains why.
2 weeks ago, economist Nigel Galt noticed something. He's with IHS Global Insight. The number of Americans filing for unemployment for the first time that week fell by almost 20,000.
And most people had expected that that might have just been a temporary blip downwards, and most people were looking for those claims to actually get worse, to rise this week.
But they didn't. Today we learned that last week that number fell again to the lowest level in more than 3 years. Scott Anderson is a senior economist at Wells Fargo, and he says that's good news. Fewer people are getting fired.
Well, you know, I think the evidence is piling up that the U.S. job market may be stirring back to life in the fourth quarter.
Take the average number of Americans filing for unemployment for the first time over the last 4 weeks. That's also down. But economists are, shall we say, cautiously optimistic about this trend. Employment numbers around the holidays can be unreliable. If the weather turns bad, construction workers can be laid off. And there's another thing. Tom Porcelli is with RBC Capital Markets.
What I think people have to remember about this claims number is that it only captures one side of the equation.
Nigel Galt of IHS Global Insights agrees.
We have to keep an eye on hiring, of course, as well as firing. These statistics today just told us about firing. That has gone down.
But hiring? Looks like we've still got a ways to go to make a big dent in unemployment. We'll get more numbers on the hiring side of the employment equation soon. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Perhaps the best thing we can say about the price of gold today is that it didn't fall as much as it did yesterday. The value of an ounce has slipped below the $1,600 mark. It wipes out the gains from the gold rally this summer. And given that gold is supposed to be the safest of safe havens, our senior business correspondent Bob Moon has been asking why the sell-off.
First off, you can blame the irresistible allure of all those profits investors have made on gold this year.
A good thing can become too much of a good thing.
Fund manager Axel Merck says as the European debt crisis grew worse and the value of gold surged, a lot of big investors flocked to the precious metal. The irony is that same crisis is now sending them back to cash while they can get it. Many fear the credit markets might seize up. Fred Schoenstein is a gold trader at Heraeus Precious Metals.
While gold was billed as a safe haven trade over the course of the last, 6-8 months, it does also have that risk element.
The risk that investors can always switch their preferences with little warning. And they now seem to consider the dollar the best way to have quick access to their assets. At Global Hunter Securities, metals analyst Jeff Wright says investors may not make the returns they've enjoyed from the run-up in gold prices, but they won't be losing money either.
You know your principal is safe as gold has become much more volatile over the past 3 to 4 weeks.
Fund manager Axel Merck says there's a lesson here for smaller investors.
How much risk can you stomach? How much volatility can you stomach? If you cannot stomach the downdraft you had in gold right now, if you're not comfortable with the ounces of gold you're holding, but you're looking at the daily price movements, then you're probably holding too much of it.
Merck says he's keeping a sizable position in gold, though, because he still considers it one of the most secure assets. He says it may be there's no such thing as a safe asset anymore. It could be the dollar, as some commentators have pointed out, just looks like the nicest horse in the glue factory. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Strong start, weak finish on Wall Street. Today we'll have the details when we do the numbers. Here are some words we haven't used to describe the happenings in Washington a whole lot lately. Bipartisan and compromise. But that's what we seem to have in at least one area. Republican Congressman Paul Ryan and Democratic Senator Ron Wyden said today they have, And here it is again, a bipartisan plan to overhaul Medicare. They said in a statement they hope this will be the start of, and these are their words, a serious debate in Washington on how to reform the country's biggest entitlement program. From our health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Gregory Warner reports.
Here's the compromise. Seniors get a voucher to use toward insurance on the private market, as Republicans want, or toward traditional Medicare, which Democrats want to preserve. Wealthier seniors, whatever that means, get a smaller voucher. They contribute more of their own money. Low-income seniors, again, to be determined, get more subsidies. Robert Leshefsky is a healthcare consultant in Washington.
It does create a market where seniors have choices and have a fixed amount of money to go out and shop for healthcare. I think it's really an elegant compromise.
As for cost control, spending would be capped at the growth rate of the U.S. economy plus 1%.
Medicare over the last 25 years has grown at GDP plus 3%. So if we can control spending at GDP plus 1%, that's something we can afford.
Then you dig into the details of the proposal, and wait, there aren't any details.
This 12-page document doesn't say a lot about how they're going to save money.
Joe Antos covers health policy for the American Enterprise Institute. He says it's implied Medicare will cut costs to compete with private plans.
Presumably, if traditional Medicare is going to survive in competitive markets, it's going to have to change the way it operates.
Which means?
Higher premiums or higher cost sharing or tighter access to preferred providers.
And this is where that whole compromise thing could break down. Democrats don't want those restrictions on access, and they don't believe that the private insurance market is cheaper. And what happens if spending does go over that magic cap of GDP plus 1%? Paul Ginsberg is at the Center for Studying Health System Change. He says the proposal is quiet about that, too.
They're not saying, the providers will pay or the beneficiaries will pay. They're really just leaving it up to Congress to deal with it in the future.
And those are words we have heard before. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
Today, the Labor Department said it wants to improve working conditions for home health care workers, the people who care for the elderly and disabled. Until now, they've enjoyed almost no labor protections. In fact, the law, as it stands right now, treats home health care workers the same as casual babysitters. No minimum wage and no overtime. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler has the details.
Talk about a growth industry. About 2 million people currently work as in-home caregivers. In the next 8 years, the industry is projected to expand by 50%, but it's hardly a dream job. Thelma Retta cares for an Alzheimer's patient.
I don't get any overtime pay. I'm paid $35 a day. Usually I work for at least 16 hours.
In the home where she works, the family treats her like a maid, but she was afraid to complain.
It's hard to find a job, so I just keep silent.
New rules being considered by the Labor Department would give home care workers the same protections as other workers, things like a minimum wage and overtime pay. Some congressional critics say the changes will hurt the industry. Not so, says the National Employment Law Project's Sarah Lieberstein.
One of the country's largest home care employers, Addis, already provides minimum wage and overtime to its workers. And they've become a stronger company because of that.
Some employers agree. Robin Schaffert is with Hand in Hand, the Domestic Employers Association.
One of the big problems today is there's an enormous amount of turnover. Treating workers well reduces turnover. That's going to improve the quality of care that our loved ones receive.
Even if costs rise because healthcare workers earn more, experts say home care will still be vastly less expensive than the same services in a hospital. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
One way to think about the European Union, setting its economic and political problems aside for just a second, is kind of like a club. And for a time, the EU was the hottest international club around. Everybody wanted to join. But adding its economic and political problems back in for just a second, what's the upside to membership at the moment? Sally Herships has that story.
Talk about a wait. Between treaties and negotiations, joining the EU could take a country years. And with all that debt to bail out and infighting, seems like the place may be going downhill. So who wants in now?
Croatia, Serbia, Bosnia.
Catherine Mann teaches economics at Brandeis.
Joining the EU has a lot of advantages for a small country.
Like the ability to live, work, or play in almost 30 countries. And you don't even need to bring your passport. It's called the Schengen Agreement. Tempting, but not necessarily enough to persuade a country to join the EU. But wait, there's more.
You might get some money out of it.
Even if the EU has to spend billions to bail out Greece, it would still have cash for its special interests, like subsidies for agriculture. The EU pays people under 40 to be farmers.
There is always money left for farmers.
Then there's security. Take EU member Estonia. It's a tiny country, and it shares a border with Russia, its massive former occupier. Stuart Johnson is an American comedian who settled in Estonia. Here's his take on why, when you're considering joining the EU, size does matter.
Look at these Occupy Wall Street protests that have basically circulated the globe of late. I mean, now they have Occupy Wall Street in France, Germany, Russia, except in Russia they call it Occupy Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania.
But aside from small countries, who wants into the EU? Turkey has been trying to get a date since 1987, but the EU may have been playing too hard to get. Catherine Mann again.
It's kind of like that movie title, He's Just Not That Into You. I mean, that's the way it is kind of with Turkey.
But now it looks like Turkey may not be that into you, EU. Turkey has realized there are other fish in the sea. İlhan Taner is a reporter with Vatan Daily, the Turkish newspaper. He says maybe Turkey should form its own union and ask some other countries to join it instead of the EU.
Maybe not yet France and Italy and Germany, but, you know, Greece.
So in the off chance Turkey is able to form an alliance with a historic enemy, how would it back out gracefully from the EU? Philip Galanis is author of the book Social Cues. He says one of the easiest ways to refuse an invitation, regardless of how aggressively you may have hinted for it, is to plead a prior engagement.
So Turkey might say, gosh, we would love to join the EU, but we've just accepted a 3-episode arc on Keeping Up with the Kardashians, and God knows where that could lead.
How diplomatic. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
So if you could pick, which troubled European country are you? We've made up a little quiz for our Facebook page. First question, how do you like your cheese? It's on our homepage as well, marketplace.org. I like mine creamy. Coming up, why, oh why, is there a restaurant smack dab in the middle of a fancy department store?
It keeps customers inside the store longer. They can have a meal or a cocktail, and then they can continue shopping.
Oh, all right. But first, let's do the numbers. Stocks surged out of the gate but limped to the finish line. The Dow Industrials held on to a gain of 45 points, about a third of 1%. Closed at 11,868. The NASDAQ eked out a rise of 1 point. Call that flat. Finished at 2541. The S&P 500 added 3 points, a third percent. Ended things at 1215. Those declining jobless claims we told you about had sent the Dow up more than 100 points at the open. But then the head of the IMF warned that the global economic outlook is quite gloomy. That's a quote. Drug maker Merck still managed a gain of 2.25%, the best among the blue chips. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.91%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Friday. A look at the prices urban consumers are paying for stuff. The Labor Department releases its monthly Consumer Price Index. A House Oversight and Government Reform Subcommittee holds a second in a two-part hearing on what the euro crisis means for taxpayers and the U.S. economy. And it's the anniversary of the Boston Tea Party. The saltwater tea was brewed on December 16, 1773. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You know, sometimes you do a book interview and it's enough to just sit in a studio and talk. But sometimes it's more of an experiential thing. There's something to actually do, which explains how I found myself out in West Hollywood last week at a store called Oleana, purveyor of fine olive oils and balsamic vinegars. I was there to meet and sample some of the goods with Tom Muller, whose new book is called Extra Virginity, The Sublime and Scandalous World of Olive Oil. And we started with a simple definition.
It's fresh squeezed fruit juice. Olives are fruit. They're a stone fruit like cherries and apricot. The sad thing about extra virgin as a legal definition is...
Back up for a second. The legal definition.
Yeah.
There's a legal definition for extra virgin.
Absolutely. Olive. It just says it can't stink. But most of the stuff that you have does stink, and it should immediately be disqualified.
Walking into this place, the visual impression is crazy because there's row after row after row of these tiny little stainless steel vats in which are all these different kinds of olive oil.
Yeah.
I mean, it's couldn't have been an extraordinary setup.
Yeah, well, 700 different kinds of olives make a lot of different kinds of olive oil. This line could go for 100 meters.
And we've got, a dozen here on the row.
Yeah, exactly.
So let's get to it. This is the Sweet Barnea EVO.
All right. First thing you do is you warm it because you want those aromatics to come up. So
hold it in your
hand.
It's a chilly day in L.A., man. It's like 45 degrees outside.
So you put it in the palm of your hand.
Okay.
You cover it.
Wow.
Okay, we'll say it's done. It's not quite done, but it's done.
So now what?
Now you take a little sip into your mouth, and then you make a really funky noise.
All right.
It's called a strippaggio.
A what?
Strippaggio in Italian. It means stripping. It's the way of getting the aromatics up into the nasal passages.
How many trips to Italy did you take while you were writing this book?
I've been living there for the last 15 years. There we go.
Mm. I don't necessarily like the way it tastes, and, and some got up into my upper palate, and it's a little bit harsh.
What that is... Because there are 200 minor components in the health of olive oil. One is called oleocanthal. It's a natural ibuprofen. So it's an anti-inflammatory.
Not everything that is sold as extra virgin olive oil or high-quality olive oil is, in fact, what you think you're getting.
No, no. In some cases, it's outright taking soybean oil, coloring it with chlorophyll, flavoring it with beta-carotene, and selling it as extra virgin olive oil. Most of the supermarket... Yeah. Fake extra virgins are made from very, very poor quality olives that are then turned into oil, which smells bad and tastes bad, and then they deodorize it, which is a refining process, and then they goose it with a little real extra virgin like this to give it a little bit of character, and they sell it as extra virgin.
It's a little bit like fake Louis Vuitton bags in a way.
Yeah. So
it's sort of, that's sort
except
of the
we're putting
deal.
It inside us.
Louis
Vuitton bags is over your shoulder, and but those producers who are really doing a good job are spending a lot of money to harvest their fruit. You know, to get it to the mill on time, to do all this stuff. Quite often, the bad oil, they let gravity harvest the fruit. It's been sitting around. They collect olives with things that look like street sweepers.
Well, give me the numbers. I mean, how big is the good extra virgin olive oil market versus, what we get at Safeway?
In terms of consumption, this is really a tiny drop right now. But there's a huge boom in interest in olive oil. I mean, 10% growth per year in America of consumption of olive oil.
Which is good.
We're the number three consumer in the world.
Behind the Italians
and the Spanish. All right.
Moving
on. Next we have, so we're moving up the intensity scale towards the big guns here.
The big guns of olive oil.
How about ultra robust Picual? Picual is a classic Spanish cultivar.
Tell me what a cultivar is. A
cultivar is a kind of olive.
All right.
You getting something different on
that? Oh, yeah, you can totally. Oh, man.
And here comes the pepper.
Wow.
I told you.
Oh, God, it's like, that thing you get with wasabi where it goes up?
Oh, yeah, that's
back
right.
Of your nose?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, I don't know that that's a selling point.
Think it's good for you.
Oleana in West Hollywood. Tom Muller's book is called Extra Virginity, The Sublime and Scandalous World of Olive Oil. Tom, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
That last one was pretty good, actually. I bought some of it. There is plenty more online. Tom put together a list of shops all over the country where you can find really good olive oil. There's an excerpt from his book and a video of our little outing. It's marketplace.org/thebigbook.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
David Gurrow was telling us up at the top of the broadcast that given the jobs numbers out today, there may finally be light at the end of the economic tunnel that we're in. Daniel Jordan wrote to say that he wants to hear more about that. He's the VP of sales at a lumber and home building company in the Mississippi Delta.
The lumber and building materials business was arguably the hardest hit area of the economy. We're doing well. There is work out there, and some people are doing well in this economy, despite what you hear on the national news.
I talked to Stephen Dubner the other day for our regular Tuesday dose of Freakonomics about food and, indirectly, the local food movement. Dubner paraphrased economist Tyler Cowen, who's got a new book out, as saying we need better technology and business sense to feed all the world's hungry, not locavorism. We joked on the way out that we get some nasty letters from local food lovers, but you went easy on us, and we appreciate that. Deb Williamson of Catlett, Virginia, sent us this.
There are ways to cook great local food inexpensively, but even if what Cowen says is spot on, good. By all means, yes, let's tax the rich by selling them expensive local food, because purchasing local food directly benefits some of the people at the lowest of all income levels, small farmers.
Finally, on our story yesterday that Avon is struggling with its famous Avon calling business model, Kelly Zatkowski of Woodstock, Georgia, says Avon doesn't need to fix the way it works, needs to scrap it.
I used to sell for Mary Kay. My mom used to sell for Avon. And the only way we really could make any money with this approach was to recruit more and more consultants. It wasn't just about the sales, which is not necessarily laid out to the person who is joining either Avon or Amway or Mary Kay or any of these companies.
Tell us what you think about our approach. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. This week, the National Retail Federation did what you'd expect a lobbying group for 3.5 million American retailers to do. It said, oh, yeah, we think holiday sales this year are going to be great. We're going to get some ground truth on that tomorrow with a special live retail show. We'll be on the road to a mall out in Commerce, California, asking around about how things are going. But cynicism about statistics aside, there is a certain something about holiday shopping. The nostalgic among you will fondly remember big department stores with magical window displays, pictures with Santa and little sandwiches, no crusts, of course, and tea at the department store's restaurant. You just can't get those things online, so as those stores fight for customers, they're putting a lot more money on the table, as it were. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
Bloomingdale's is bustling from the army of perfume sprayers stationed near the entrance to Santa Land, where antsy kids are waiting in line for their turn, to 40 Carrots, the health food restaurant known for its big salads and frozen yogurt. Heather Saxon is waiting for a table with her mom and sister.
It is a family trip. We're showing my mom the city. Every time we're in New York, we come to Bloomingdale's for the frozen yogurt.
Department store restaurants are back in a big way. Macy's in Midtown is undergoing a $400 million renovation. It's getting a wine and chocolate bar, a pub, and a white tablecloth restaurant with views of the Empire State Building. Nordstrom is opening a string of old-fashioned grills. And Lord & Taylor has brought back the ladies' lunch in New York with the upscale Sarah Beths.
We know the value of the excitement of food. It brings a lot of energy. It brings a lot of theater back into the store.
Jack Haruska is executive vice president of creative services for Bloomingdale's. It has six restaurants at its flagship 59th Street store, including a Magnolia Bakery that opened this year.
You can get anything you want on the internet. When I actually leave my house and I want to go to a store, and I want a bigger experience.
I love department store restaurants. I mean, it reminds me of when you used to get dressed up to fly. Like, it was a big deal to eat a meal inside the department store.
Jen Drexler is a retail analyst with Insight Strategy Group. She's standing outside Macy's Cellar Restaurant, where she used to come with her mom and now brings her daughter. She says department store restaurants can tap into powerful memories.
Before Macy's was Macy's, it was Bambergers. And on your birthday, you got to come and open a treasure chest with a key and pull out a present. And I remember those days really well, which just makes me happy to be here.
That nostalgia is what department store restaurants are banking on now. They've never been huge moneymakers. Instead, they pay for their valuable floor space in other ways, says Jan Whitaker, author of The World of Department Stores. She says in addition to making kids and women feel welcome when other restaurants didn't, department stores have used their tea rooms and cafes to promote products and host special events.
When they saw the potential of the restaurant, they realized that it was a marketing opportunity. They really started to get a lot of mileage out of the restaurants.
And that's still the plan. Bloomingdale's will start tying restaurants into store-wide promotions, like, say, for Diane von Furstenberg's Homeline. The store might debut her new tablecloth designs in one of its restaurants. Macy's new pub will stay open after hours to lure a male crowd into the store. But the real value of department store restaurants is simple, says Suzanne Johnson, general manager of Saks Fifth Avenue. Its popular cafe, home of the Saks salad, overlooks Rockefeller Plaza.
It keeps customers inside the store longer. They can shop and they can have a meal or a cocktail, and then they can continue shopping.
Nothing like a cocktail to help take the edge off those credit card charges. Susan Zott is holiday shopping with her friend.
We came here to shop, but it came to be around lunchtime, and we heard that they have some good soup here. So, you know, your legs get tired from walking around.
Department store restaurant mission accomplished. Not that convenience doesn't have its drawbacks. Again, Bloomingdale's Jack Haruska.
Do I eat in our restaurants all the time?
Do you have a favorite?
I do, unfortunately, because it's why I need to go on a diet. I like Flip, which is our gourmet hamburgers and french fries and chocolate milkshakes. And it's just, I can't go there very often.
In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, courtesy of the reportage of our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore. Credit Suisse, Heidi tells me, has figured out a way to make life harder for wannabe rogue traders. Turns out, more vacation time. The bank is going to force its traders to take an extra week of vacation every year without access to their computers or BlackBerries, not to make sure they get their rest, heaven forfend, but so company auditors can peruse their computers for questionable activities. All right, that's Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, Lisa Tucker, Celeste Wesson, and Loretta Williams are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time, we're going shopping live from the Citadel Outlet in Los Angeles, hard by the Golden State Freeway. All discounts, all the time, gang. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM. That's American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.